Hello, and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 221st episode of the Nauticast, titled End of the Road, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Arya 13, in which Arya Stark says goodbye to Sandor Clegane, and also to Westeros. But at least she gets Needle back. I think that's a fair trade.
You know, every time I threw a tantrum asking for a dog as a kid, my parents would just get me a new toy, so this kind of makes sense to me.
Somehow they knew.
And I'd like to welcome our guest on for today. It's actually my old podcasting buddy from A Scene of Ice and Fire, in which we were going through Game of Thrones, one scene at a time. It's Andrew Mearns.
Hey, guys. It's great to be on. I had my own sort of exchange with the toys, but I had asked for a pool table for Christmas when I was 6 years old, I believe, because we'd gone to a family friend's house for pre-Christmas party, and they had a pool table in the basement. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Can we have one for Christmas? And my mom's like, yeah, let's consider that. And instead, I got a Game Boy and a note from Sansa explaining, well, listen, I talked to your mom, and the pool table, I don't know about that. honestly, worked out great, because I got Tetris, Link's Awakening, Super Mario Land 2, so good deal.
You were set on the right path.
Exactly.
A Game Boy can play many games.
Oh, it's true. Yeah.
I would have blamed the elves. That's what I would have done in the note. I would have been like, you know, the elves, they work so hard they can't make a pool table on short notice. It's a labor issue.
Is that you, short Gimli? Deadline.
Never. No one trusts an elf.
Yeah. Yeah, the dwarves are behind this one. But it's good, really great to be back in the Aeswaf universe. I was watching the show. I started jumping on with the show actually right before season 6. That was when I personally got into it. I had moved into an apartment where, for whatever reason, their plan was that they were paying for HBO and most of the internet too. So I was like, okay, well, someone else is paying for HBO. Finally, I'll watch Game of Thrones. And, you know, sunk its hooks in and I've been really involved ever since. Obviously, we did the Scene of Ice and Fire podcast from 2017 to late 19 when, you know, we finished all of the first seasons, which I think is pretty good. And if it petered off after that, that's okay, because the world got kind of crazy in 2020 and beyond. So that's fine. And obviously, it paved the way for Manu to jump onto this show, which I had already been listening to with Emma and Jeff. So really glad to have my own opportunity to pop back in here and talk about one of my favorite characters, Arya.
Thanks for coming on. We're so glad you could come.
I was going to say, I spent 3 years fucking around on A Scene of Ice and Fire in Westeros, and this is my Braavos, the Nauticast era.
Welcome to the House of Black and White.
Exactly.
I guess that makes me the kindly man. It's true. I am
kind. It is very true.
I am horribly, hideously old behind my mask. Wait. So, as always, our spoiler warning, prepare to be spoiled for all 5 A Song of Ice and Fire novels, the 3 Duncan Egg novellas, any histories, any interviews, any Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. Our question this episode comes from one of our patrons, Arkham Resident, which is great. I didn't know they allowed podcasts there, but good for them. What's an action scene you're looking forward to covering in the next books? Great question. We got a little action scene in this chapter. Feast and Dance certainly are less action heavy than A Storm of Swords or A Game of Thrones or Clash of Kings for that matter. There are a couple fights. I do have a soft spot for the big ship battle with Victarion in A Feast for Crows. It's not exactly the most complicated or even important, you know, fight in the series, but there is a certain dumbass metalhead attitude toward with Victarion going, "Come kill me if you can." That hits me. Hits me right where I itch. Scratches me right where I itch.
I'm going to take a little different tack than the traditional sword battles or even ship battles here. As most people may know, my favorite action movie is The Fugitive. So I'm thinking Theon and Jane's flight from Winterfell when they're actually running through the snow. You know, the washerwomen are stabbing the various guards. And then it has its very own dam jump sequence when Theon and Jane have to jump off the walls of Winterfell into the snow. Only chance at survival. No chance, no choice. I know there are a bunch of obvious ones, but I just think that one's going to be a lot of fun to cover. And of course, I'm going to find some way to tie it back to Dr. Richard Kimball in all things. So that's my choice.
I'm not Arya Stark. I don't care.
There you go. Perfect. It's perfect.
For my answer, I'm going into the land of the hypothetical here, but I've always been fascinated with how George exactly plans to write out the Hodor hold the door reveal. Mm-hmm. And in the Winds of Winter, I have, and again, this is like purely aspirational because we have no idea what it'll look like, but I do trust George.
Nor does he.
And yeah, maybe that's the thing. But I feel like if it ever does get to paper, it's going to be really good. He said, you know, as Speaker for fans for like over a decade now, but
yeah. I mean, there's the great action scenes he's written cutting between different POVs, but you know, cutting between different time periods within the same set piece, that's a whole extra level jump.
To give people maybe a more traditional answer, I think when Brienne fights the Fae Hound near the end of a feast when she's protecting Gendry and the kids at the end, when I think of sword fights specifically in the last two books, the most recent two books rather, that's the one that pops out first and foremost. Although I will say, you know, maybe those Jaime Ilyn Payne bouts get pretty heated and maybe those will be a lot of fun to talk about as well.
Those are the conversations cut even deeper than the duels in those scenes. Yes. But yeah, the Brienne Rord scene, obviously everyone loves No Chance and No Choice right before she starts the fight. But then the bit where she stabs him and whispers sapphires as he dies, ooh, that gives me chills. That's good stuff. That's a good choice too. So thank you to Arkham Resident for the question. If you want to ask us questions we are forced to answer here on the Nauticast podcast, you can head on over to patreon.com/Nauticast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our regular episodes, exclusive episodes every month, and the chance to ask us questions that we answer at the top of our regular Song of Ice and Fire episodes. But we're here today to talk about an action scene in this book, Storm of Swords. We're here today to talk about Storm of Swords Arya 13. So let's go ahead and jump into the synopsis. Outside the inn on a weathered gibbet, a woman's bones were twisting and rattling at every gust of wind. I know this inn. There hadn't been a gibbet outside the door when she had slept here with her sister Sansa, under the watchful eye of Septa Mordain, though. Oh, don't worry, Arya. Septa Mordain can't bully you anymore. She's dead. Hooray. Arya doesn't want to go in on account of the ghosts, but Sandor would happily fight a whole army of ghosts to get a cup of wine. Arya briefly considers running off with the horses before ultimately deciding to follow Sandor inside. She immediately regrets this decision when she sees who's waiting for them. Looking for your brother, Sandor. Polliver's hand was down the bodice of the girl on his lap, but now he slid it out. Looking for a cup of wine. Innkeep, flagon of red. Clegane threw a handful of coppers on the floor. I don't want no trouble, sir, the innkeep said.
Then don't call me sir.
His mouth twitched.
Are you deaf, fool? I ordered wine.
As the man ran off, Clegane shouted after him,
Two cups. The girl's thirsty, too.
Oh, what a good surrogate dad giving the kid wine. What is this, France? Polliver is accompanied by a boy Arya doesn't know, and a man she knows all too well. The Tickler, a.k.a. Gregor Clegane's pet torturer. The boy, a squire, starts mocking Sandor. Apparently, Gregor had some choice insults for Sandor when he heard that little bro had run off after the Blackwater. Of course, Gregor can get away with this shit because he's the size of a mountain. This kid? Not so much. But he doesn't listen when the Tickler warns him to stop pissing Sandor off. Thankfully, the innkeep soon returns with a flagon of wine and two cups, though Sandor drinks half the former before he even notices the latter. Give Sandor some credit, though. At least he's paying for his drinks, which, as Sandor tells the innkeep, is more than Polliver and company will ever do. The innkeep quite sensibly decides to run for his life, as do the rest of the locals. Polliver catches our heroes up on what's been going on. Very nice of him. Gregor took Harrenhal from the Bloody Mummers, most of whom fled beforehand, leaving Vargo Hote to his grisly fate. But then Gregor left for King's Landing, summoned by Cersei to take part in Tyrion's trial for Joffrey's murder. Oh yeah, Joffrey's dead, by the way. Arya tries to be happy about that, but she feels like it doesn't matter now that Robb is dead too. Another piece of news. Tyrion married Sansa, and so it's assumed they kill Joffrey together. Neither of our heroes react well to that. Arya can't believe Sansa would ever marry Tyrion, let alone kill Joffrey, and Sandor just hopes Cersei tortures Tyrion to death. How dare he marry Sansa, Sandor thinks. That's my child bride, I call dibs. One more bit of exposition before the big fight. Polliver says they finally found Sansa's sister, who's being sent off to marry the Bastard of Bolton. That goes right over Arya's head, who thinks that, wait, no, Sansa doesn't have another sister. But Sandor gets the joke and laughs his ass off. To give him credit again, he doesn't so much as look at Arya, lest he give them both away. Moot point, unfortunately, because when Gregor's men finally insist that Sandor come with them, he tells them to fuck off, and the big fight begins. The Tickler grazes Sandor's neck with a throwing knife. Sandor rises to his feet and meets Polliver blade to blade. Arya knocks down the squire with a well-thrown wine cup, but she isn't so lucky when she tries the same trick on the Tickler. Meanwhile, Polliver is driving Sandor back, and Arya realizes that Sandor got drunk too quickly to fight. Yeah, we've all been there. Arya picks up the flagon to throw, but the squire has recovered and grabs her arm. She manages to snatch his dagger from its sheath and bury it in his stomach. Polliver and the Tickler had driven the hound into a corner behind a bench, and one of them had given him an ugly red gash on his upper thigh to go with his other wounds. Sandor was leaning against the wall, bleeding and breathing noisily. He looked as though he could barely stand, let alone fight. "Throw down the sword and we'll take you back to Harrenhal," Polliver told him.
"So Gregor can finish me himself?"
The Tickler said, "Maybe he'll give you to me.
If you want me, come get me."
Sandor pushed away from the wall and stood in a half-crouch behind the bench, his sword held across his body.
"You think we won't?" said Polliver. "You're drunk." "Might be," said the hound. "But you're dead."
His foot lashed out and caught the bench, driving it hard into Polliver's shins. Somehow the bearded man kept his feet, but the hound ducked under his wild slash and brought his own sword up in a vicious backhand cut. Blood spattered on the ceiling and walls. The blade caught in the middle of Polliver's face, and when the hound wrenched it loose, half his head came with it. Nice. Don't try that at home, kids, but nice. The Tickler quickly realizes that on his own, he is no match for Sandor. But it turns out Sandor isn't the one he should be worried about. Arya grabs the knife the Tickler threw earlier and uses it to stab him from behind.
"Is there gold hidden in the village?" she shouted as she drove the blade up through his back. "Is there silver? Gems?"
She stabbed twice more.
"Is there food? Where is Lord Beric?"
She was on top of him by then, still stabbing.
"Where did he go? How many men were with him? How many knights? How many bowmen? How many, how many, how many, how many, how many? Is there gold in the village?"
Eventually, Sandor drags her away from what's left of the Tickler. The butcher's work isn't done yet, though. The mortally wounded squire is now begging for mercy, claiming that he only came along to the inn because Polliver promised to get him laid. Sandor tells Arya to give the squire the mercy he's asking for, and Arya does so with her sword Needle, which she retrieves from Polliver's corpse. Yay, best friends, back together. All we need now is for Nymeria to show up and probably eat all the bodies. Sandor declares that if Gregor's men are all the way out here, they must hold the Ruby Ford as well as Harrenhal. Our heroes have no choice but to ride for the port town of Saltpans, hoping there's a ship there that can take them to the Vale so Sandor can finally sell Arya and get back to drinking himself to death. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Sandor's injuries are so bad that he can barely climb into Stranger's saddle, let alone stay there as they ride. They find a perfect hiding place, a grove of willows near some rocks. Sandor orders Arya to boil some wine in his helm and pour it over his wounds. Several agonizing minutes later, Sandor passes out from the pain, and Arya dresses the wounds as best she can. Then she takes care of the horses and settles herself down to sleep.
"Sir Gregor the Mountain," she said softly, "Dunson, Ralph the Sweetling, Sir Ilyn, Sir Meryn, Queen Cersei."
It made her feel queer to leave out Polliver and the Tickler. And Joffrey, too. She was glad he was dead, but she wished she could have been there to see him die, or maybe kill him herself. Polliver said that Sansa killed him, and the imp. Could that be true? The imp was a Lannister, and Sansa... I wish I could change into a wolf and grow wings and fly away. If Sansa was gone too, there were no more Starks but her. Jon was on the wall 1,000 leagues away, but he was a Snow, and these different aunts and uncles the Hound wanted to sell her to, they weren't Starks either. They weren't wolves. Sandor moaned, and she rolled in her side to look at him. She had left his name out too, she realized. Why had she done that? She tried to think of Micah, but it was hard to remember what he'd looked like. She hadn't known him long. All he ever did was play at swords with me. "The Hound," she whispered, and "Valar Morghulis." Sandor isn't dead by morning, but he's close to it. A few hours into the ride, he falls from his saddle like Khal Drogo. Arya doesn't know any blood magic like Miri Mazdur. Thankfully, I guess. So all she can do is get him some water and sniff at his wounds, which, they don't smell good, let's just say that. Arya considers riding off and leaving him there to die, but then she thinks she ought to kill Sandor herself as justice slash vengeance for Micah. She draws needle and shifts into a water dancer's pose, thinking through Cyrio Farrell's lessons about moving smoothly and quietly, but when the dead leaves crunch under her feet, Sandor immediately wakes up.
"You remember where the heart is?"
he asked in a hoarse whisper. As still as stone, she stood.
I was only— "Don't lie," he growled. "I hate liars. I hate gutless frauds even worse. Go on, do it."
When Arya did not move, he said,
"I killed you, Butcher's boy. I cut him near in half and laughed about it after."
He made a queer sound, and it took her a moment to realize he was sobbing.
"And the little bird, your pretty sister. I stood there in my white cloak and let them beat her. I took the bloody song, she never gave it. I meant to take her too. I should have. I should have fucked her bloody and ripped her heart out before leaving her for that dwarf."
A spasm of pain twisted his face.
"Do you mean to make me beg, bitch? Do it. The gift of mercy. Avenge your little Michael. Micah."
Arya stepped away from him.
"You don't deserve the gift of mercy."
The hound watched her saddle Craven through eyes bright with fever. Not once did he attempt to rise and stop her. But when she mounted, he said,
"A real wolf would finish a wounded animal."
"Maybe some real wolves will find you," Arya thought. "Maybe they'll smell you when the sun goes down." Then he would learn what wolves did to dogs.
"You shouldn't have hit me with an axe," she said. "You should have saved my mother."
"I take it easy, kid. You already saved your mother. I mean, kind of, not really." Arya rides away, and several days later stumbles into Saltbands. There are indeed ships there, three of them. Two are river galleys and therefore useless for her purposes, but the other is a trader fit for sea travel. With purple sails and a purple hull, oh good, it's the Danes! Oh, nope, sorry, got Chloe excited for nothing. In order to get on board, though, Arya will need money. She sells Craven to the woman who used to run the stable before one side or the other burned it down. The woman says that while Craven clearly came from a castle, Arya just as clearly didn't, though the irony, and so the woman is going to rip Arya off, which Arya has no choice to accept, because the alternative is dragging her before the local nobles and declaring her a horse thief, for which she'd be lucky to escape execution. Arya shows frankly heroic restraint in not murdering the woman right then and there. Arya returns to the docks with her pathetic amount of silver, where she finds the crew of the purple ship loading it up with trade goods. She manages to get the captain's attention and offers to pay for passage to the wall so she can reunite with Jon Snow. Sadly, God, aka George R. R. Martin, has other plans for her. Not only does Arya not have enough money to pay for passage, but this ship isn't even sailing to the wall anyway. "We're headed home," the captain says. "Oh, where's home?" Arya asks. "Braavos," he replies. "That sounds familiar," Arya thinks, and pulls out the old iron coin given to her by the faceless man who called himself Jochen Hagar. The captain turned it over and blinked at it, then looked at her again. "This? How?" Jochen said to say the words, too. Arya crossed her arms against her chest. "Valar Morghulis," she said, as loud as if she'd known what it meant. "Valar Dohaeris," he replied, touching his brow with two fingers. "Of course you shall have a cabin." And that is the synopsis for A Storm of Swords, Arya 13. What'd you think of it, Andrew?
So this is as good a chapter as I could have hoped to make a guest appearance on for this podcast. Like many fans, I gravitated toward Arya Stark. And I think at the end of the day, she's still my favorite character in the series. I don't have to make a full spiel of it because otherwise we'd be here for the Mondo episode of the podcast. But it's easy to sympathize with her plight while admiring her fortitude to try to forge her own path in the best way she can. I just personally would not go the full death cult route. That's not for me. It's for some people. Works for Arya in a way. Here we're catching Arya at a transition point in the series, where she's bidding adieu to both the Hound and Westeros as a whole. For now, though I don't think she'll see the Hound again, we'll get into that, but for now she's saying goodbye to Westeros. In a chapter that might as well be a microcosm of her journey to date. There's misguided mentors, casual murders that shouldn't feel so casual, the return of her beloved needle, scrapping about on her own, some semblance of hope, quote-unquotes, on a new horizon, and of course, so much internal conflict. And that's all with me only lightly touching on Sandor as an all-time fascinating character in the story, who also, again, we're saying goodbye to here.
So that's Arya's curtain call for Act 1, A Song of Ice and Fire, and possibly Sandor's for the series, pending an epilogue? Well, that dog is one for later discussion. Arya 13 stays in the mold of late Storm chapters, pivoting the character from the first three books, with a healthy dose of looking backwards, to the unexplored frontier of the next two. So we gotta cross our T's and dot our I's which in this case means Arya ditching the Hound and picking up Needle. It's a tight, action-packed chapter with one of the series' more memorable goodbyes. Again, question mark. And in my opinion, gets a healthy bump of appreciation for the show adapting these scenes well. And yes, we will be discussing how many fucking chickens Sandor Clegane will eat today.
It's a lot.
All that you have, every single one. And yeah, this is one of those chapters where I think you can see George writing for TV. Unlike the last Arya chapter, which was very literary, I guess that's the polite way to put it, but it was deliberately meandering and directionless to reflect how lost Arya feels in the wake of the Red Wedding. And she still feels that way. Arya doesn't get a new path forward until literally the last words of this chapter. But George clearly wanted to cap off this storyline, the longest one in the Storm of Swords, with something more distinct and memorable on its own terms. And like you said, it's really tight. A farewell to Sandor, a reunion with Needle, several names crossed off Arya's death list, even a callback to Jaqen H'ghar, and it's all dealt with quickly and concisely. It's like George, as you were saying, is summarizing Arya's story so far, feeding it all into this battle at the inn and its aftermath, before sending her off over the horizon into what turns into a different kind of story entirely.
There and back again, the tale of Arya Underhill. underfoot. Arya returns to a familiar location, one not far from where she and Micah dueled by the Ruby Ford. That is to say, the place of original sin between her and Sandor, and the inciting incident of her character arc. It is the Inn at the Crossroads, a well-worn setting with an appropriate name. Once, long ago in a Game of Thrones, the roads led Arya Stark south, where she was someone. Now, at the end of Storm, her road turns east, where she can be no one. Perhaps fitting, then, that the inn is now decorated by a hanged woman, foreshadowing her path of death with the faceless men.
We're also not far from where Arya and Jory had to force her beloved direwolf Nymeria to leave them. After attacking Joffrey like a good and noble pup, Nymeria innocent, let it be known. We're reminded of her through the wolf dreams that do briefly pop up in this chapter as well and throughout her story, and Arya is following in her dog's paw prints as Nymeria is very well could be hovering around the edges of this outskirts of the story right here.
That's true. Even though they've parted for so long, they've always been with each other, and it's in parallel to John wanting to get back with Ghost, as happens over the next couple of chapters. And yeah, the first thing we see in this chapter is that corpse, that skeleton hanging outside the inn. It's almost like a banner waving in the wind there. Instead of House Stark, it's House Death, aka the House of Black and White. That's where Arya's going. The last time we were here at this inn, it was from Tyrion's POV at the end of Book 1. Tywin had taken over the inn as his headquarters in the Riverlands before moving on to Harrenhal in Book 2. And he's the one who hanged Masha Heddle, whose bones those are blown in the wind, because she committed the crime of, checks notes, being present when Catelyn kidnapped Tyrion. Can't have that.
How dare she?
But now it's like, well, Catelyn's dead. And Tywin has sentenced Tyrion to death, and soon he'll be dead himself at Tyrion's hands, and the Riverlands as a whole are no longer the battlefield for those two equally matched factions. They're under the control of one side while the other one licks its wounds in the shadows. So the whole context in which Masha's corpse made sense is gone, emphasizing just how arbitrary and cruel Tywin's violence was. Like, there's no one left to intimidate. The bones are just bones. And unlike Tyrion, Arya lacks the context to even know whose bones those are. In a way, this showdown at the inn is the final boss fight of Arya's journey in the Riverlands. This is a direct confrontation with the monsters in human skin that have ruined her life and so many others. No more working through Jaqen H'ghar, no more staying on the sidelines while the Brotherhood does the fighting. Arya's in the game. But in another way, George undercuts any catharsis you might get out of this even before the fight breaks out, even before they go inside. Already those bones speak to the futility of everything that's happening here. Not only could we die, but we won't even be remembered. This inn comes up again in A Feast for Crows, where it plays a complicated role in Brienne's storyline. It's a symbol of hope, with yet another pipsqueak gang of orphans running around inside. It's a proving ground for her chivalric values, that great no chance, no choice moment going up against Rorge. And it's also ultimately a trap, where the Brotherhood capture her and put her on trial. But that's Brienne's POV. This is Arya's, and what's happening in Arya's story right now is that she's realizing there might be nothing left for her in Westeros, at least not right now. So naturally, to her, the inn is just a graveyard, this bleak ruin where nothing can grow. Why stay here when, as she says, there are ghosts everywhere?
And Arya even thinks about making a break for it when the Hound goes inside at the very beginning of the chapter. And she's at such a crossroads, like no pun intended, that she doesn't have a plan, or to quote Phoebe Buffay, a pluh, about what she would do next. There is just nowhere that she can even envision on going other than some vague ideas of maybe going up to the wall, which she'll touch on later in the chapter. But right now, it's just like, well, I guess I'll just follow this guy again.
One of my favorite fantasy tropes is the inn. You can rest, you can get a bite to eat to heal your HP, often there are side quests to unlock, and you can get updates on the world at large from NPCs. Lucky, for a two-person RPG squad, they know the current patrons at the bar, whom Arya names as Polliver, the Tickler, and Third Guy, whatever. What's more, Arya knows the blade that is hanging from Polliver's waist, but she, like George, doesn't name it. Not yet, anyway.
And one of my favorite tropes in any kind of story is the room going silent when our heroes walk in. Mm-hmm. Whether it's walking into an inn in a fantasy story, or the inns you see so often in kung fu movies, or swinging open the saloon doors in a western, you see that so often, the effect is always the same. Piano player stops playing, looks over anxiously. It immediately raises the tension, while also posing the question of who exactly is intimidated by who? Should our heroes be afraid of these assholes, or should these assholes be afraid of our heroes? Turns out the answer is both.
Yeah, you can practically hear the good, the bad, and the ugly theme just sort of playing in your head as you're reading in the book.
Wow, wow, wow. Tumbleweed goes by.
Yeah. And so it's George once again reminding us of the impact of casual violence on the small folk of the realm. The innkeeper and the other patrons just want to find some damn respite in this dumb world. But because Polliver and Sandor are who they are, a scary scene finds them anyway. The innkeeper immediately is like, I don't want no trouble, sir. And that accidentally makes things worse for the innkeeper through no fault of his own, because sir is like calling Marty McFly chicken in the later Back to the Future.
What did you call me?
No. Yeah. What about chicken? But even then, like, George writes that the locals were leaving too. It's as if they're finding a Homer Simpson hedge to back into. Like, we don't want any part of this. Just let us be. But no, this is just the violence finding them anyway. Unfortunately, it seems like the casualties on their end are mostly avoided, but just a dangerous world. And even Arya is back to biting her lip until it's literally bleeding.
Yeah, that danger is there, even though everyone's being polite at first, because there's no reason not to be, unless you're going to start fighting immediately. But that slow burn, that menace is gradually growing, because Sandor is a very well-known traitor to the Lannister cause at this point. On the other hand, it's, you know, even before that, these were never Sandor's friends, clearly. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't spend time, other than this, seeing interactions between Sandor and Gregor's little cronies. But we, in the Forsaken, the Euron Greyjoy chapter released from the Winds of Winter, we see Euron interact with Euron Greyjoy's cronies, and they make fun of him and allude to Euron molesting him and act like that's shame on Euron, and he should be embarrassed about that. So I'm betting the vibe has always been similar, that Gregor's cronies know exactly what Gregor did to Sandor and kind of win favor with him by making fun of Sandor too. That's definitely the vibe. But Sandor just pretty much ignores them at first, which adds comedy to a very tense scene, something the show took and ran with, as we'll get to later. The only one who actually gives voice to the tension is the nameless squire, who knows only what the other men have told him. Kind of a shadowy reflection of Arya with her many mentors. Their mantra is always running through her head. And it makes me think earlier in Arya's story of Chiswick, the soldier at Harrenhal that she had Jaqen H'ghar kill, and the story he told about the boy he was training to rape and kill. This squire seems to be in a similar role. But George plays the kid for laughs, like that he just doesn't know enough to realize that they're in trouble. That, like, yeah, sure, you've heard stories about Sandor being cowardly in battle, but that doesn't change the fact that he's currently standing right in front of you with a much bigger sword than the one you have.
Yeah, this squire is the faceless idiot on Twitter who used to have an egg avatar, who was talking shit about an athlete who missed a big three in a big moment only to get ethered when Kevin Durant quote tweets him. And unfortunately for the squire, that normally wouldn't suffice for Sandor, but he's so used to this insult already that he even heard it from Arya at the end of last chapter and laughed at her that it hardly even registers on the list of grievances that he has with this party at this juncture.
Yeah, not even on the top 10 list of Sandor's problems, most of which are little wine emojis, just all the way down. Not only is the squire a reflection of Arya, he's a reflection of Sandor, because Polliver says the squire's being annoying because he drank too much too quickly. He can't handle his liquor. Well, then he shouldn't drink, says Sandor, not realizing that he's also describing himself. That's something we see a lot with Sandor, especially in this book, is that he's a portrait of an alcoholic. Like, he can't, it seems like he can't even fully process the danger from these guys because his brain and body are just screaming, need wine now. That's it. That's all he can focus on. And the threat of Gregor's men throws Sandor's character into sharp relief. Like Stannis, he's a study in ambiguity, all the more so because, again, like Stannis, he's not a POV character. So you have to infer what he thinks from what he says and what he does. On one hand, Sandor warns the innkeep that Gregor's men won't pay. Quite the opposite, they'll take him for everything he's got. And that allows the innkeep to escape, along with everyone else, back into the hedge, like you were saying, just quietly not being there anymore. Well, that's Sandor just saved their lives, right? Good for him. What a mensch. What a true knight, even. But then the conversation turns to Tyrion and Sansa. We know Sandor has a thing for Sansa, to make it simpler than it probably really is. And also we know that he despises Tyrion. So no wonder he reacts poorly to this. But when he says that Cersei should have Tyrion tickled, aka tortured, Arya thinks, oh, okay, so you're just like them after all. You're no better than the tickler himself if you want to go around torturing people. So which is it? Is Sandor an exception to the rule, or is he an example of the rule? I think he's both. He's a hero and a villain in the same skin. Just like his face, he's split down the middle.
Arya and the Hound have basically been in the wind since the Red Wedding, with little news of what else has transpired since. Joffrey's dead, which fails to spark any real emotion in Arya. She clearly wanted him dead, he was in her prayers, but his death doesn't fill the hole left by the death of Robb or her lady mother. The feeling of loss will linger with Arya for a long while, so much so that she will be unable to fully let go of memories of her family while in Braavos, a metaphor held within that named blade still hanging at Polliver's belt.
And not to get ahead of ourselves, because we'll talk about difference with the show adaptation, but this sort of contrasts with Arya's reaction to hearing of Joffrey's death on a Game of Thrones, where at separate points she talks about, you know, I just wish I was the one to have done it, and then she mentions it later too. But since the show is not necessarily going through Arya's internal monologue, she could just be putting on a show outwardly with how she says she feels about it. But all the same, it still feels a smidge too much a small play for laughs moment when it's really just a somber reminder that so many people she loves are now gone too. And she really can't take all that much joy from it.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, that it's just a reminder of everyone that she's lost. And George, I think, sums up the futility of vengeance in one line here. Joffrey was dead, but if Robb was dead too, what does it matter? Arya was trying to hold on to the idea of redemptive violence or purposeful violence. Violence is for something. It's about accomplishing a goal, it's a tool for a goal, and then you put the tool down and the violence is over. But as she's wandered through the wasteland left behind by the war, she's met people following a different path, one in which violence exists for its own sake and will never, ever be allowed to end. Jaqen H'ghar has no face of his own. Even his name is a lie, like so many of Arya's. He lives only to kill, not for a goal, but as a goal. Beric Dondarrion kills for better reasons, but he still won't ever be allowed to stop fighting and go home. As he said, he couldn't even find home at this point if he tried. Eventually, he kills himself the only way he can, by passing on the burden of the second life to Stoneheart, who, like Jaqen, lives only to kill. And then there's Sandor Clegane, who declared that killing is the sweetest thing there is. I think he was kind of projecting or putting on airs in part. I think he was just saying that to sound tough and to intimidate Sansa, but I think at some level he does believe that, or maybe I think he's scared to not believe it. Arya doesn't actually want to be like that, but the only way to avoid that path is to hold on to her heart, hold on to something worth living for and worth living for that's not killing. And right now her heart has just been broken too many times over. Even the death of my enemies will not put my heart back together because Robb is still dead and so is Ned. And we as readers don't want them coming back because we've been beyond the wall, we know what that looks like. Why kill if it brings no satisfaction? But on the flip side, why love if it brings no satisfaction either? That's why the Faceless Men are able to tempt her. They say, Kate, give it all up. Give up the identity. Give up the dream that hurts you. Just be alone with death and you won't feel anything.
Otherwise, Arya and Sandor also learn of Tyrion and Sansa's nuptials, the fate of Harrenhal, and what's up with the Riverlands. A lot of this, like the previous Jaime chapter, is setting up the political context for A Feast for Crows, especially the bits about the Blackfish and the Bracken Blackwood feud.
The Hound's vague plans for ransoming Arya continued to fall apart in his hands, since he had thought of going to Riverrun for the Blackfish to try to sell Arya to him when he saw how hard it would be to get to the Vale, and now Hyest is suddenly audible again, back to vague Vale plans via the Salt Pans, and those don't materialize because, you know, he gets pretty brutalized toward the end of this chapter. But again, what would have worked? It feels like in a world where the Hound survives this conflict without horrific wounds that change his arc, they would have been ambling about together like they were at the end of season 4 of Thrones before that plot got taken off the rails too.
Arya has trouble parsing all this news, especially her sister's marriage, as she boils it down to what Sansa would want. Arya, we must remember, has been removed from court intrigue for some time now, and on a day-to-day basis, survival has been her one and only goal. Sansa has gone through the political crucible to understand what her name means and what privilege it carries much better than Arya has, who just hasn't had to entangle herself in any of that. Similarly, she doesn't understand the comment about Sansa's sister being bound for Bolton's bastard. What other sister, she thinks. The Hound, familiar with the coin Lannisters used to pay, is much quicker on the uptake there, though he keeps it to himself.
Yeah, that's a great little moment, because Arya is generally cynical. How could she not be? But she is still a kid, and there are still a lot of experiences she hasn't had. So it honestly never occurs to her that the Lannisters would just point at another girl and say, "Hey, look, it's Arya Stark. We dare you to say otherwise." And that's not because Arya thinks the Lannisters wouldn't stoop that low. She knows damn well how low they stoop, including the men in this room. It's because, like you say, she hasn't really spent much time around politicians, so she doesn't know how they think, she doesn't know the kind of moves they make. But Sandor does. Even though he hasn't made this kind of decision himself, he has spent a lot of time around those who do, and he immediately recognizes what Tywin did. And how can he not laugh at that joke? That Sandor only found the real Arya after abandoning the Lannister cause entirely, so he can't take her to them. And that Polliver and the Tickler never realized the real Arya Stark is right in front of them. Like, Gregor's men attack and get themselves killed because they want to drag Sandor back to Gregor as a prisoner. They're clearly imagining, oh, he's going to be so happy, he's going to reward us, he's going to pat us on the head with his big giant hand or whatever he does. But the irony is, he'd be much more interested if they brought back Arya.
So this book is called A Storm of Swords, and George plays that steel song one more time on the jukebox as the bar erupts into violence. While Sandor Clegane may be the best fighter of the bunch, he's drunk and outnumbered, and Polliver is a big man all his own. Arya tries evening the odds by taking out the squire, eventually dispatching him with a thrust into the gut, calling back to the stable boy from A Game of Thrones. Even in the middle of his action set pieces, George is tying off and calling back to all parts of Arya's journey beforehand, to give it a sense of climax and finality before scooting her off to her next big adventure. Whether Sandor knows he's making a last stand or not is unknown, but part of me thinks that a belly full of wine while engaging in mortal combat with his brother's men isn't the worst way for him to go out.
Yeah, good point. Sandor keeps saying that he wants to get paid for Arya to recoup the money he lost to the Brotherhood, but what would he do with that money? Well, what was he doing when the Brotherhood found him? Drinking himself to death. Absent a reason to live, Sandor is trying to get himself killed. His berserker heroics during the early stages of the Battle of Blackwater fell apart when he was faced with the wildfire. Everyone interprets that as cowardice, but that's not really Sandor's problem at this point. It's that he cares so little about himself that he makes decisions like get shitshow drunk when a fight is clearly going to break out 10 seconds later. And even that would be romantic in an idiotic sort of way if it weren't for the fact that he's responsible for Arya's life, not just his own. So the question becomes, can Sandor ever be part of a pack again? Or did his brother take that part of him away? All that aside, the fight itself, I think, is really well done in the same tense, close-quarters combat way as Brienne's fights with the various Bloody Mummers in A Feast for Crows. George does a great job keying us into the emotional dynamics here. Arya's panic as she sees the odds stack up against them, Sandor's vicious glee at turning the tables on Polliver, might be, but you're dead, and the Tickler's subsequent pant-shitting fear. And how quickly that turns, it reminds me of sports. I think any baseball fan can tell you that there's a whole world of difference between one strike for a hitter years and two strikes. One strike is fine, we're gone, he can still get it. Two strikes is, oh my god, he's almost out, the world is ending. That happens to the Tickler here. When it's 2-on-1, Polliver's doing most of the work. They have an advantage. When it's just the Tickler against Sandor, suddenly it's all over.
See, the problem for them is that Sandor was basically born with an 0-1 count after what Gregor did to him when he was 5. So he's like, oh, bro, I've been living in this two-strike approach almost. So, you know.
I can see him with the Bane mask. You just came up to the plate. I was born with an 0-1 count. It's beautiful.
While Sandor dispatches Polliver's head in gnarly fashion, Arya goes buck wild on the Tickler, who has clearly fucked with Arya's psyche. Earlier in the chapter, she has a bout of PTSD just hearing the Tickler ask Sandor a question. But now, it's Arya's turn to ask the questions, which she does so mockingly and frantically as she goes stabby-stabby on the Tickler's body, putting Caesar's assassins to shame. And that leaves unnamed third guy, who Arya gives the gift of mercy with her very much named blade, George finally dropping the needle when she sticks it between the squire's ribs. There's power in a name, and George was keen to let the reader know what weapon Arya was lusting for all chapter, but only delivers the name when it's put to deadly use.
It's as if, by reclaiming this sword, she's reclaiming her own name. Ironically, given that the squire she's killing with needle is never given a name, and none of these men ever had any idea who Arya was. Like, imagine what was going through the Tickler's head as she killed him. Why the hell is this random half-pint brat repeating my torture catchphrases back to me? Again, George is going two ways at once here, giving us the cathartic comeuppance we want before draining that catharsis dry. The Tickler is one of the easiest to hate characters in the whole story. His whole personality is torture, so much so that he also never gets a name. Not only does it feel righteous to watch him fear for his life and then lose it, but then Arya adds in the mantra. That's the great turnaround. Now you're going to suffer what you made others suffer. But not really, of course. The Tickler dies pretty quickly. Quicker than the squire does, anyway. He doesn't face anything like the pain he inflicted on people. And even if he did, what next? He'd be like one of those Karstark men in the cages at Stony Sept, the men to whom she gave mercy. The only difference is that she bore witness to the Tickler's crimes, whereas by the time Arya met those Karstark men, they were beyond harming anyone. Imagine the flip side. Imagine Arya saw those Karstark men rape and kill people at Stony Sept, and the Tickler was just like a corpse she came across in the wild. She'd probably feel bad for him, not knowing anything about who he is or what he did, even though he'd be the same person. My point is not that Arya should have just let the Tickler live and leave and keep on torturing. Nonviolent resistance only works when your opponent has a conscience, and Gregor's men have none. My point is that what Arya actually wants is not the Tickler's corpse. She wants him to never have tortured anyone. She wants Lami back. She wants her father and her brother back. And the fact that violence can't bring them back threatens to leave her broken, unable to go home to love and be loved ever again.
Arya's story has many low personal points, but this feels like it could be up there or down there in terms of rock bottom. Depends how you want to look at it. In its own way, it's worse than when she learned separately of Ned and then Robb and Catelyn's deaths, not far away from her. But because now she's enacting some vengeance that amounts to just stabbing a corpse, it's just... you're like, oh no, what is going on? And it's to the point where even Sandor is like, Jesus, let's take a breather in his own manner. That is like the worst violent man you know has just made a great point. This is literally just overkill from Arya because she has no answers right now. Just unrelenting fury with what has happened to her life. And as has already been alluded, all those Tickler questions have just come storming back to her in this moment.
And really, what could you expect of her at this point? She's a kid who's been on the run and all her mentor figures have been one flavor of murderer or soldier or another. So she really hasn't had like a Ned or Catelyn in her life during the most traumatic things she's experienced to help her process and channel these things into less stabby outlets of energy. So that was the fight portion of this chapter. Next, appropriately, comes the flight, as Gregor's men are not too far away from the inn. Sandor is weakened beyond belief, needing help to get a horse and will have to dress and redress his wounds throughout the next day. The battle, the injuries, hell, the weight of life is starting to force its gravity on Sandor Clegane. The river gets in on the sympathetic nature game, tiring out here at the end of a storm of swords after spending much of it flooding and rushing. Like Sandor Clegane, it's time for the waters to ebb and find peace for a time.
That's the perfect way of putting it. And yeah, even within the chapter, it works like it. You feel the momentum ebb and the intensity of the action is fading back to the mundane realities of life on the road that we were looking at in the last Arya chapter. And Sandor won the fight, but he also lost it. He can't keep up anymore, and that was thanks not to his cowardice, but to his alcoholism. And while the Quiet Isle, where he almost certainly ends up, feels like an almost mystical healing spot, his own Avalon, the emphasis here is on mud, blood, sweat, and tears. He's not getting to drink the wine anymore, instead it's being boiled and used on his wounds. He's in this very vulnerable position, crying and screaming, just like he was after the fight against Beric when Arya last tried to kill him. Well, actually, Arya's tried to kill him several times. One of the times in which Arya tried to kill him was right after the fight with Beric, but she couldn't because he was crying, and she was like, you cry? That's so weird. I can't kill you now, and it's the same kind of mood here, at least at first.
For the last time in A Storm of Swords, Arya says her prayers, finding her list of names shortened by 3, which sadly also runs parallel to her list of immediate family members that have been lost. Arya takes a moment to appreciate that she might be the last of the Starks, all other living relations being Snows and Tullys. At some level, this has to inform her decision to head east from Salt Pans, as there is little besides Jon at the Wall for her left in Westeros.
And she leaves out a fourth name, Sandor. Well, not Sandor, because in her list, he's always been the Hound. Maybe that's why she left him off, because at some point, without her fully realizing it, he became a person to her, not just a snarling metal monster. It was the Hound, it was the monster who killed Micah, at least in Arya's mind, not the man, because the man she's currently caring for is no longer capable of killing anybody. And as she thinks, she can't even remember what Micah looked like. A heartbreaking moment, just like Dany realizing that she's forgotten the name of the girl Drogon ate for breakfast.
Or in the show, I always think about the scene when Mark Addy as Robert Baratheon is talking to Cersei about how he can't even remember what Lyanna looked like, and she was the cause of everything in this war in its own way.
Yeah, it's a great example. It feels like insulting and galling, but what can you do about it? That's just time. We carry our ghosts with us, and we try to respect and honor our beloved dead, but the reality is that we live our lives with the living, and Arya has spent much more time with Sandor than she ever did with Micah. And Micah would never have come with her to King's Landing. Obviously, it would have been much better if he was alive, for him. But for Arya, he would have been out of her life by now anyway. That innocent childhood world may as well be another planet to Arya now. She has more in common with Sandor. It makes me think of the line from Ripley in Alien 3, when she's staring down the alien in that one, and she says, "I've been fighting you for so long, I don't remember anything else." That's where Arya is now. And so she can only hope that Sandor will just die by morning on his own. Like, let the gods take care of this one, because I don't know if I can bring myself to do it anymore.
In season 6 of the Throne show, when Arya is playing the game of faces with the Waif, she tells the Waif that the Hound was on her list, and then the Waif smacks her. This is a lie that was detected and immediately corrected by Arya. And when the Waif presses her on it, she says, "Why? Didn't she want him dead any longer?" Arya says, "She did and she did not." She sounds confused. "Yes, she was. Is this just an excuse for me to fondly recall how my jaw dropped when I saw Faye Marseille in Andor and got to see her do more than just the Waif's monotone stuff? By the way, watch Andor. It's great. I don't need to tell you guys this."
Hell yeah.
Andor, but now on Blu-ray and Steelbook.
Yeah, as I've seen on your Twitter.
Remember back to Arya 7 and 8 when Sandor would ask Arya if she knew what dogs do to wolves? Well, now we move on to what wolves do to dogs, as the Hound has reached the end of his journey. Both Sandor Clegane and the Hound will live on after this moment, though the combination of the two may never ride again. It's a painful and cold moment for all involved. Arya plans to do it all quiet-like, but Sandor, never one to sleep with both eyes closed, ends up egging her out to do the deed. There's an internal struggle here for Arya. At first, she wants to do it, both to be free, but also for the hundreds of Micahs that Sandor has surely killed. She'd be unshackling herself and avenging many with a single needle thrust. At the same time, though, Sandor has protected her for a long time now, especially at the Twins, where she likely would have gotten herself killed, either on purpose or on accident. But when Sandor begs her for death and tempts her with insults, that's when Arya decides he's not worthy of mercy. In her last chapter before Braavos, and twice Arya has had to choose whether to give the gift of mercy, subject to all her prejudices and biases and experiences. The first was the squire at the inn, and here with Sandor Clegane. At the House of Black and White, that choice will essentially be taken away from her and instead be dictated by the Faceless Men.
Here she's thinking about it in terms of justice, which is basically a meaningless concept to the Faceless Men. And I think it's also a question of responsibility that Ned always said, you do your own killing. Arya thought about that with Jaqen and Hagar. She was like, I know, Dad. Dad wouldn't like this. And she's thinking, okay, this is kind of more what he would approve of. But she pulls back. And I think why she does that is a complicated question. She has the answer. She has an explicit answer that she doesn't deserve it, especially after the kind of the horrible things he's saying, which is a great sick joke that he's saying that to make her mad enough to kill him, but it makes her so mad she refuses to kill him. That's pretty great. But, I mean, did those Karstark men deserve the gift of mercy she gave them? Again, only because she didn't know any of their victims personally. And mercy isn't about deserving. It's kind of the whole idea. So I think this is also Arya trying to compensate for forgetting what Micah looked like. Just like how Sandor forgets his name. Like, in that moment, Arya goes, uh-oh, we're the same person. I forgot Micah's face, you forgot his name. Maybe Arya is desperate and worried that she's becoming more like Sandor and wants to make this break from him as much as she possibly can in the moment. Not even kill him. And I think it is also, like I was saying, about how upset and disturbed she is by his vulnerability whenever he shows it, whenever Sandor cries like he does here. And it's because it makes such an uncomfortable contrast with how vicious his words are, especially about Sansa. And at the same time, you see a little self-awareness creep in there when he says, I took the song, she never gave it. Like Sandor is realizing, oh, that wasn't in my feverish mind. I turned that romantic and it really wasn't. I'm one of the monsters. It wasn't something she wanted to give me that would heal me. It's something I stole like everything else. And he hopes to die so he doesn't have to feel it. But instead, Arya leaves him alone with it.
You know, I went back and forth on whether we should eulogize Sandor Clegane here or not. Mostly A, because he doesn't die. Or as much as we think, we don't think he dies. So it'd be kind of weird. But Sandor Clegane has been a real force in this narrative through these first three books. And it might be worth taking a second to just appreciate that fact. I think we mentioned, like, he's pretty much up there with Stannis Baratheon as probably the best non-point of view character, or at least the most fleshed out and the most complex that we actually spent some time with. I'd maybe throw Varys in there, but he's a character that kind of runs behind the scenes as opposed to being frontward. And where Stannis has kind of been pretty much siloed into his own plot threads for much of this, Sandor Clegane has been very heavily invested in the Stark storyline, which is the heart of the story, if you know where the heart is, and especially as protector to the two Stark girls, which obviously complicates and deepens our relationship with him as a character, because he is a big, violent brute that basically lives to fight and drink. But at the same time, he's been the, you know, thing protecting some of our most beloved characters this entire time. And George never really softens him, despite the fact that he is a savior to the girls. He is literally hard to his very last words. And I think it's a really tough balance to run. And someone like Sandor Clegane can very easily run into parody or caricature where it no longer feels like a real character is there. It's just the steel dog that rides into battle and yells and swears and curses and all that. But I think this is just a really difficult character to like really make feel authentic. And I think George has done it, and doing it through the eyes of two little girls essentially is all the more powerful.
Yeah, I can't act as though this is just like the Jaime Lannister transformation, but this is as close as we're going to get to making a guy who could be a 2D character more three-dimensional and more understanding. You would learn more about his background and what made him the way he is. And while you're not actually hearing him actually narrate anything that's been going on, you almost don't even need to, because the emotions are there on his face.
Yep, perfectly put. I think you can't embrace him and you can't dismiss him. And I think George does a great job of writing that line of never softening him too much, but never putting him beyond your attention entirely. And yeah, we keep coming back to that line. You remember where the heart is because of how it resonates not only within Arya's story, but his own. That's what he's been trying not to do. He's been trying not to be soft. He's been trying not to make himself vulnerable again, but it just keeps happening, especially with the Stark girls in different ways. And maybe that's what the ultimate focus of his story is remembering where his heart is and trying to invest himself in it again. And in a perverse way, Arya ends up giving him mercy after all by letting him live. She meant to just make him suffer until he died even more horribly. But as happens, almost certainly they don't confirm it's him on the Quiet Isle, but we all know it is. What ended up happening is she made his you don't have to call it redemption or spiritual retreat or whatever you want to call it. She ended up making that possible. She contributed to that without even realizing it. As Beric Dondarrion said, God is not done with Sandor Clegane.
When Arya walks into the inn to start this chapter, she thinks to herself three. Three there are regarding the mountain's men. When she arrives at Salt Pans, she thinks three. But this time, it's the number of ships outbound from the port. For some quick geography, Salt Pans sits near the mouth of the Trident, where the river flows into the Bay of Crabs, which in turn outlets into the Narrow Sea. Despite this seemingly primo real estate, Salt Pans never developed as a major city. According to the World of Ice and Fire, this was at the express direction of the River Kings. So thus, it remains a small town, supposedly the dominion of House Cox, with not much going on aside from the quiet isle that's a bit out into the bay. We'll come back here with Brienne in A Feast for Crows, but by then, the city will be nearly abandoned, as, quote-unquote, the Hound, or Rorge as we know it, will have put the town to the torch and the survivors would make their way to Maidenpool.
Yeah, that's grisly to come back, knowing that everyone here is already dead by the time we get to Brienne and A Feast for Crows. I was thinking about the bit where Arya gets cheated for Kraven, the price of Kraven, and there's just like chilling sentence where Arya thinks, huh, maybe I should stab her to death. No, people are watching. Ugh, can't do that. It's just great to show how ingrained violence as an option is for Arya. Like, yeah, obviously this woman's ripping her off. That sucks. Boo. But compare that to the people who've been murdering and raping across the Riverlands that Arya's tried to get vengeance on. This is a little sign, oh, Arya is in, when you have a hammer, everything it looks like a nail mode now. Now that Arya's thinking violence as her one tool, it's always the solution.
I mean, from there, she could just know, I would just give her a 1 out of 5 on Google reviews. That's all she exactly. needs to do. You don't need to kill her.
That's the best revenge. The best revenge is living well and leaving bad reviews. That's what I always say. But then, yeah, I was thinking about, oh, right, then that woman's probably dead now. That woman probably got the worst kind of comeuppance possible for her cheating of Arya by getting wiped out. So I was thinking, like, oh, that's, like, Arya wishes death on this woman, and then the Hound, not the Hound she left behind, obviously, but a version of that guy shows up and kills this woman. It's kind of a weird, sick kind of karmic loop that happens there where Arya is almost responsible for this death anyway. And I love the bit in Feast for Crows where you keep hearing about the Hound and you go, well, I, the reader, know that Sandor Clegane was left dying under a tree. And then you find out it's not him, of course, it's Rorge. But in a way, that Hound figure has become something bigger than any one person. It moves on to Rorge immediately, which really disturbs Thoros. It seems like it's almost possessing people. Like it's this one of the many unquiet ghosts all across the Riverlands.
I'm just hopeful that Kraven could finally get some peace, even if maybe Kraven runs away when the bad stuff starts happening.
She's very good at that. That's Kraven's whole thing. That's her name.
It's not hang around a lot. It's just Kraven.
It's a stand around and get killed horse. No. Good for Kraven.
So Arya does eventually find passage with one of the three ships, the Titan Daughters, and not with that paltry return she gets for Kraven, but with the iron Khorne Jekin Hagar gave her back in Clash. He clearly knew Arya would need this to unlock further quest lines. The Bravosi captain, at first incredulous at Arya's attempts to buy passage, immediately serves when the coin is presented, putting real juice into the phrase Valar Dohaeris. That connection between the merchant class embodied by the captain and the faceless men is something we will attempt to tease out as we explore Braavos in A Feast for Crow. The entire city seems to have something going on just beneath the surface. Between the merchant class and the Iron Bank and the House of Black and White, there seems to be a united purpose in the bureaucracies of Braavos that I can't quite put my finger on just yet, but thankfully we have some time to spool that out. To the extent that George has given us enough yarn to that end.
Mwah, beautiful yarn metaphor, sir. Yarn metaphor of the year. Yeah, and this is one of those cases where one person's ambiguous is another person's vague. Like George might be just be sketchy on purpose here. This is kind of forced. George, I think, does have his thumb on the scale that Arya just happens to find a boat from Braavos, that she just happens to have the coin from Jaqen H'ghar at this exact moment. It's not exactly organic in the way. I think it's more. It feels less forced to me when Sandor takes Arya, because you've established as him following the Brotherhood for a couple of chapters. This is just so clearly like, oh, George gave you a nice little gift of a boat you can take. But it is emotionally effective because it's not Arya's first move. Her first move is to try to get to the wall, to try to get back to Jon. And she only goes to Braavos because she can't. She can't get back to her family. She can't get back to her identity. And so she chooses the faceless men. She chooses the opposite of that. without even realizing it. I love the bit at the end. She literally doesn't even understand the words she's saying. She doesn't know what Velor Morghulis means yet, which is easy to forget to come back to this chapter, that Arya still hasn't had that defined for her, but she will.
She pulled the get out of jail free card without really knowing where exactly she was getting out to. But
exactly.
This unknown world inhabited by an assassin who Arya barely knew during her Harrenhal imprisonments is literally her only option. She can't even go back because she already sold Kraven for a forced pittance. This is her only lifeline, and it's hardly even a lifeline. It's just the one path available unless she wants to walk away, steal another horse, and ride off somewhere. I mean, she's not riding up to the wall, so distant land of strangers, here we come.
Yeah, one way out to do another Andor reference here.
Yes.
But since I got my old Scene of Ice and Fire buddy back with me here again, and we never did quite make it to season 4, I thought it might be cool to talk about how this chapter was adapted for Game of Thrones, split over the season 4 premiere, Two Swords, and its finale, The Children. So we'll start with the end scene, which I want to back up a little bit and talk about season 4, which is the start of Game of Thrones as a juggernaut, coming after the Red Wedding moment to end season 3. I believe there was a 5 million jump in viewership from the previous season's premiere going into season 4. And just tracking the premiere episodes of Game of Thrones, Arya is barely in the season 2 premiere. She's a last second reveal alongside Gendry, and then she's not in the season 3 premiere at all as the show goes to more focusing on certain characters per every episode. But here in season 4, Arya gets to close the curtain on the season premiere, and at this point Arya is probably top 2, top 3 in terms of fan favorites among the entire cast.
And it really is such a great moment when they're playing the final moments of season 4 and you hear Ramin Djawadi's The Children, and it's just such a great number, one of my favorite ones that he did in the entire show, and just playing over the background, and you see, you know, she's sailing to Braavos, and they'd been sort of hinting at her connection to Braavos with Arya referencing Syrio and water dancing and a few previous episodes with the Hound. So they've been lightly laying the track for, hey, by the way, remember Arya has this like connection to Braavos, and then they, you know, just like Arya in the book hits the get out of Westeros free card and off she is to Braavos.
I agree. They did a good job setting that up because that is, like I was saying, that is a hard pivot in the book. And I'm sure when they were writing season 4, they were like, all right, we gotta make it seem like we didn't just invent a fantasy kingdom city out of nowhere here. we promise you, you've heard of this place.
Remember season 1?
You sure cool. do.
So that season 4 premiere is titled Two Swords, like I said, and the ostensible Two Swords is the two swords that get melted out of ice at the beginning with that cold open with Tywin Lannister. But I think, as is wont during peak Game of Thrones, the episode titles often had multiple meanings, and I think the two swords really meant Arya and the Hound at the end, especially in a scene in which Arya does recapture her needle from Pollivar.
And they do a wonderful job of just making Pollivar the most callous mini-boss villain, where he's like, oh, they want to torture, torture, torture. He's talking about torture as if his boss is making him attach to the proper cover sheets to TPS reports. It's like, you realize what you're actually doing, right? But like, he just doesn't care, and that's the whole point.
He's just a middle manager of violence, exactly. Yes. And he's got that great line. It's something like, he's talking about Joffrey, like, no one's standing in his way, so no one's standing in ours. Great way of just kind of summing up how bleak things are in Westeros in the wake of the Red Wedding. And like you said, man, we opened with Tywin melting down ice, which I remember just made me so mad watching it the first time, and just how his smug he is in his victory. And it's the same thing here. It makes you, gets you on the edge of your seat, makes you long for some kind of violence, even if, even
makes
when
you
that...
want someone to shoot him on a toilet.
Exactly. Exactly. Huh. Oddly specific.
And, you know, when the Game of Thrones writers riffed on their own, it was always a hit or miss proposition. But I think they actually cooked with the fucking chickens and Sandor Clegane, which is not, you know, not something directly from the books. But they basically just had Rory McCann, who has, you know, great comedic timings, things we might know from things like Hot Fuzz. And he just, you know, keeps going on about eating some fucking chickens and who's going to pay for them. And if people are going to die for chickens, it's just a really great bit that, you know, I believe it is a DB Wise, David Benioff episode in terms of the writing. And here it actually worked.
Yeah, it's like, you're going to die for some chickens? And then he's like, someone is. And you know, by that point, his tone is so deadly serious that he's not joking around. He wants to get some fucking chicken.
Rory McCann, I think, did a great job with the one-liners. I think even really better than Peter Dinklage by the end of the show. Because I think it generally felt like something Sandor would authentically say. Not because of just how angry and violent he is, but also just because of how tired he is at this point in the story. Where he's like, he's not even trying to be clever. He's just absolutely done with pretense. And he just...
Season 4 also brings us, what the fuck's a lami?
Exactly. I don't care if they ate your friend. And you cut to Maisie throughout kind of being apprehensive, but also starting to grin at how easily Sandor is taking them down, which speaks to where the kind of the different position this comes in their story in the show versus the books, because... in the books, of course, this is the end of the Arya-Sandor relationship, at least for now. So you get a little moment like Arya thinking, oh, he wants to torture Tyrion. He's just as bad as them. I hate him. Whereas in the show, they have a whole season to go together. So you want to have little moments of connection and Arya kind of bonding with Sandor. So it kind of changes the emotional tenor of the scene that way.
And then the fight scene that ensues is pretty brutal, as is Game of Thrones want to do. That I specifically remember is when Sandor is tussling with someone on the crowd. When there's like a knife between him and this man he's wrestling, and he basically grabs the man by the back of the head and just stabs his face into the knife repeatedly. That's that good HBO violence that I pay $15 a month for. Otherwise, the retaking of Needle is very similar to kind of how it's done, or at least a very smart adaptation of how it's done in Arya 13, where she kills the one guy first, and then she grabs Needle from Polliver, and then basically, instead of repeating the Tickler questions at her, starts repeating the lines Polliver said to her and Lami when he took Needle in the first place. So it's true in spirit, if not in the exact kind of dialogue and words that are happening there.
Yeah, but don't worry. She already had her own excessive violent outburst with the knife attack, pretty similar, in the end of the third season, right after the Red Wedding, when she and the Hound encounter a random camp of Fremen, which I was typing this out in my notes, looked very close to Fremen, but then not quite. But yeah, they meet a pretty grisly fate, and not unlike the Tickler.
And then this episode and the scene basically ends with Arya getting a horse, which was the conversation point between her and Sandor earlier in the episode. And they get an ending shot where the two of them are riding through a burning riverland, which for a second made me think, like, oh, they're going to fucking do a Feast for Crows, right? They're going to be wandering through the riverlands with 8 different point of views to see what it's like after, you know, many years of war.
No, I love that for the same reason that it's just so bleak looking, like almost comically, cartoonishly bleak, which is what I love about the Riverlands at War, that George really cranks it up to 11 to the point where it's not even just horrible, but how are any of you alive at this point? How are there any people in the Riverlands now? Yeah, I love that shot.
Yeah, and it looked very Mordor at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring movie, where they're just like going off to the marshes. But I do appreciate that they did in the fourth season at least have some small moments with the common folk, whether it's the people that the Hound robs, who they do later revisit in season 7, or just the guy who's like waiting to die, and Sandor shows like that's how you give the gift of mercy to Arya. So touching on it a little bit, albeit not in the same Feast for Crows way.
Yeah. So hopping over to the season 4 finale, before we get our goodbye to Sandra Clegane, we do have a completely show-invented scene where Brienne and Podrick run into Arya and the Hound, and that ends up delivering the fatal blows to Sandra Clegane that he will, I guess, kind of not die from, but, somewhat die from. And this is, you know, a very heavily debated adaptation choice. I think it's one I'm in favor of, specifically because it felt like an organic kind of change. Like, they had obviously played with the timing of the story by splitting up this Arya chapter, by putting Brienne on the road a lot earlier than she is in A Storm of Swords. So they made a couple changes to the stories, and this felt like a kind of a logical outgrowth of that, as opposed to like, oh, we want to have Brienne and Hound fight. How do we do that? It feels like it isn't manufactured like Clegane Bowl is in season 8, where it's clearly they just wanted like to give the fans the thing they wanted to see. Whereas, you know, no one really talks about who would win Brienne or the Hound, but it is something that kind of is nascent in all the who is the best fighter in Westeros conversation. So they were able to have a little fun in the space. And I actually think the scene itself of them fighting is really well done. It does like, it has like two phases, one where they're fighting with swords, and that is set to Ramin Djawadi's music. There's like helicopter shots and drone shots, and the camera's kind of swooping over everything. And then they both lose their swords. The soundtrack totally drops out. And then they basically start rolling in the mud, kicking each other in the nuts, poking out eyes. Like, it turns into just like, you know, a scratch and claw and fist fight after like being this kind of like epic traditional fantasy sword fight. And I like how the like trappings of cinema, the soundtrack, the camera work shifts in congruence with that change in the actual fight itself.
Yeah, and just to briefly note it, the show does smartly set up why Arya might be interested in joining Brienne, just in their short dialogue together, learning about how Brienne grew up fighting swords and how that obviously made an impact on Arya. And we do see that later in the show when Arya has her train with her a little bit in Winterfell. But the Hound, at least to her, smartly undercuts this by pointing out, oh, that's like Lannister sword, Lannister gold. This is someone that cannot be trusted. And Arya just instinctively knows based on that, that she cannot trust her. And it does sort of also put her in the point of like, well, what can I trust if I can't, like, if my first instinct was wrong here, when it will be wrong down the road. And I also say this is a nice moment of Podrick just being smart and knowing things that Tyrion taught him just from being around the Lannisters, to know from a previous episode that Arya was traveling with the Hound when they were at the inn with Hot Pie. So he already knows that, like, okay, this the Hound is with Arya, so if we see the Hound, we might see Arya, and that's what sets it all up. And it's really an all-timer of a fight on TV, since there's nothing glorious about this. It is just vicious, two combatants who both have our sympathies in various ways, and it's unrelenting, with a brutal ending, as Manu said, with the Djawadi score cutting out. Brienne went Mike Tyson on Sandor. Goodness, not pretty.
And that gets us to the Hound's actual death, returning back to the book material being adapted here. And it is very similar, you know, down to the words and what he's asking for. And I think what really works here is the performances by the two actors, both Rory McCann and Maisie Williams, who are just amazing all the time as Sandor Clegane and Arya Stark. Their actual rapport on screen, you can really feel that. And I feel there is something added by the quiet, really subtle desperation in McCann's eyes as he's saying these awful things, and the just the absolute stone-cold dead look that Maisie is giving him back. I think that's something that where the performance actually helps elevate the material, which is already A++ as is.
Yeah, you can imagine what it looks like, but just to see the way that Maisie Williams delivers it, or just delivers the silence, is incredible. And there, so Arya and the Hound's first scene on the road together in season 3 has her trying to sneak up and kill him with a rock, only to learn that he can absolutely sense her, as he does in the books during their last meeting. He's like, I know, like, he hears her assuming like the water dancer pose. It's like, oh great, just kill me. But Maisie and Rory's rapport is A+ from the jump, and she runs the gamut of so many different emotions in mixed company with him. Even relief at points, like when she finds out that he wants to ransom her to Robb and Catelyn rather than going back to King's Landing. Maybe she will find a way to get back to family after all this. But as always, it always ends with ash in her mouth. And I don't want to go all the way down the rabbit hole of the Hound and Arya's reunion in season 8, let alone the Hound's return to the show writ large. Some of it works, some of it not so much. But if they did end their connected story here, it would have been perfect. Again, the stuff later is not the worst part of the final season or anything like that. It's fine. But this just rang so true to their complicated bond.
Look at that. We had a whole Scene of Ice and Fire episode within the episode.
And that was your episode of A Scene of Ice and Fire. Please follow us at...
Please follow us at this account that's not tweeted. It's an Easter egg.
So taking us into foreshadowing and groundwork, we had a lot of setup here. We get set up for basically Jaime's entire plot in A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, from what Polliver tells us about what's going on in Harrenhal, that that was kind of left for the Bloody Mummers and the Gregor's men to knock around in for a while, that Jaime will have to clean up. We hear that the Blackfish is under siege at Riverrun. Jaime will have to deal with that. And we hear that the only real fighting in the Riverlands right now is between the Blackwoods and the Brackens. Guess what? Jaime's going to have to deal with that, too.
Yeah, you know, this is a lot of A Feast for Crows, and who knows how much of it was in George's mind when he's sure at this point of the writing. But he's clearly invested in what's happening there, whether he was going to show us or not, because this is maybe the second or third chapter where he's heavily gone into this is what's happening in the Riverlands right now since the Red Wedding, since we no longer really have eyes on there. The previous Jaime chapter was all about this, and now Arya's kind of hammering the nail into the coffin. So we know this is a major focal point in George's eyes, whether how much much it would factor into his next book writing, what he knew at this point, who knows.
Another bit of foreshadowing in terms of Feast for Crows is Brienne. Also, who knows how much George had in mind. It's clear at the end of this book, Brienne going off to have a quest was part of his plan, but he also planned to build in a 5-year gap. Who knows? But there are elements here in this chapter that crop up in Brienne's chapters. Like Polliver mentions that Randall Tarly is holding Maidenpool. That's where Brienne will go to have a couple of extremely unpleasant scenes in A Feast for Crows with Sam's dad. And that he mentions that not all the Bloody Members were killed at Harrenhal. In fact, most of them weren't. Most of them went on the run. And Brienne will have to do some mop-up duty there in A Feast for Crows. And I could see that vaguely being in George's mind because Brienne had that earlier horrible altercation with the Mummers. I wouldn't be surprised if George always intended for Brienne to meet up with some of them someday and get some payback.
Yeah, that's...
You know, I don't know if anyone ever has any good interactions with the Mummers or Randall Tarly.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Randall would hate that comparison, but that's about right. Y'all are truly the same.
Yeah, with all the political turnover in the Riverlands, like obviously Gregor Clegane has taken Harrenhal. And this chapter, Arya 13, kind of answers what else is going on with that Harrenhal crew. And this answers the Gregor half. And then the Bloody Mummer half, we just kind of learn they're in the wind. And Brienne will very righteously take out a lot of them in her next book.
So, moving into theory and discussion, we touched on this briefly, the Arya-Sandor reunion that we saw in the show. Obviously, we haven't seen anything like that in the books. So, I want to ask you guys what you imagine an Arya-Sandor reunion scene would look like in the books. Do you think it would be a similar tone to the show, different? Where do you think it might happen? Do you think anyone else will be there? What do you think?
I kind of don't think it'll happen. It just doesn't seem like their narrative paths are going to cross in that way. I really have no idea where Arya's story goes specifically after Braavos, other than probably King's Landing, and I can't really imagine the Hound heading there unless he does end up being like the voice for the faith in the like a trial by combat against the Mountain. But I don't see that happening either. So, but if they did get together, I feel like probably the show's adaptation would be fairly accurate in terms of what they report. Be like, oh, you got tough, but I respect that. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, for me, I'm also going to say no. I think the show was a little bit the tail wagging the dog with the rapport that McCann and Williams had. I do feel like narratively in the books, I feel like there's more like weight to a potential Sansa and Sandor recombination somewhere down the line.
I agree.
And I think that's probably the more likely. I'm of the mind that Arya is going to be heading north following Braavos, whether she has time to make it to King's Landing or even to the Riverlands to meet Lady Stoneheart. Like, those are all like major question marks. Like, I can think of like 3 to 5 plausible possibilities. But I think Sandor, if he has anything left to do, I think it would be with Sansa. And I don't even think Clegane Bowl is happening, but I do think something with his grudge against his brother will manifest or at least be narratively touched upon again. If they meet again, let's say, I don't know, Sunspear. Let's just go wild. Let's just say they're going to meet in Sunspear somehow.
They go dinosaur hunting in Sothorios.
Yes.
I think I'm a little more optimistic about the possibility of a reunion there, just because I think Arya and Sansa will also share the same space eventually. So they might just, as in the show, they might just all be kind of be part of the same crowd and bump into each other at dinner. But I do agree that emotionally, I think Sansa and Sandor have the more kind of charged relationship, or the relationship where there's more under the surface or more to explore, however you want to put it. The Arya-Sandor relationship, kind of the appeal of it is that it's very blunt and obvious what the relationship is, which is Sandor looks at Arya and goes, oh, me. Okay. I get it. Other than maybe Arya just being aware that he's alive, that her mercy turned out differently, there's not a lot to resolve here necessarily. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of words left unsaid. They really got it all out.
They hit the code
here at the end there. I do think it would be, you know, it would be if they meet again, it would only be in passing, in the same way that, you know, John and Theon ran into each other at one point on the show and they had a tense scene. But it's like there's not that much for those two to say to each other because Theon has a much more important relationship with Bran. That's where the focus of that is going to be. The only reason I think they might run into each other again is just because Nymeria is still hanging around the Riverlands and Arya's definitely got to pick her up again at some point. But, you know, Nymeria is perfectly capable of running north to meet her instead. She's a good wolf. she can go wherever she wants. So that's going to wrap us up for our episode on A Storm of Swords, Arya 13. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so glad that we were able to set this up.
Oh, no, this is a lot of fun for me. I've been listening to you guys from the jump, from when Jeff was on the show, too. So really great. And it's been helping me just, like, read through the books again as well, just because I did not read the books until after the show ended and it became clear that, you know, we weren't going to get wins anytime soon, so I might as well catch up on the material that we have. If you ever do any House of the Dragon stuff, I've been really enjoying that show too, looking forward to that returning. But nice to, again, as I said earlier, dip my toes in the Song of Ice and Fire water once again.
It's great to have you back.
Thanks everyone for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps new listeners find us. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacastasoiaf, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our regular Song of Ice and Fire episodes and exclusive access to multiple episodes every month. You can shoot us an email at notacastasoiaf@gmail.com and follow us on social media at notacastasoiaf. And you can find me at Poor Quentin.
And I'm Manu at Manuclear Bomb. You can find me covering The Lord of the Rings over at My Brother, My Captain, My Podcast, where we just dropped an episode on The Fall of Osgiliath, but maybe more importantly, mine and Emily's thoughts on Dune Part 2, as well as much of Shogun. We recorded it before the last couple episodes, but if you're interested in our thoughts on either of those items, they are in that episode.
Hell yeah, everyone check that out. Andrew, you got anything you want to find people at home to check out?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me on Twitter at MernsPSA. I write about baseball a lot these days. I mean, I always have. But I do Yankees coverage at Pinstripe Valley. I'm the managing editor over there for the SB Nation blog. I write on SB Nation sometimes too on baseball writ large, and also write at Baseball Prospectus. So if you have any interest in the old game of 60 feet, 6 inches, you know where to find me.
So coming up next on the Nauticast, next week I'm jumping back into Star Wars, my 6th episode on The Empire Strikes Back, aka episode 5, aka The Good One. That's going to be out for all of our $5 and above patrons next week. A couple weeks after that, I'll be wrapping up my coverage of Fever Dream, George R. R. Martin's 1982 vampire novel. I'll be covering chapter 34 and the epilogue to that book for all of our $5 and above patrons over on our Patreon. And then next time in the Song of Ice and Fire, it's A Storm of Swords, Samwell 4. Remember Sam? He made it back. And now he's got a whole new set of problems to solve. Good for him.
We've all been trying to solve the Stannis problem for a long time. Sam's not the only one.
And he also has the Jano Slint problem to solve, and the John is even more emo than usual problem to solve.
There's a lot of problems.
A lot on Sam's shoulders. He's got broad shoulders, but still, too many problems. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Thanks again to Andrew for coming on, and we will see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, Samwell 4.